Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The day today is November 28th, and this is episode 356. This is going to be part two of our series on the Ottoman collapse with Ryan Gingeris. And so I think let's just get right to it. Where we left off was really on the eve of the Great War, 1913, 1914. So now we're going to pick up, first of all, thanks again for joining us, Ryan.
Yes,
and,
thanks very much. And, this is great to be here. Thank you.
Good. I'm glad. Our listeners, I think, are going to really appreciate it. In fact, on the Radio Warnerd Facebook page, we have subscribers from all around the world. I mean, probably about half are American and half aren't. But they're very active and very history hungry, especially as it ties into the present, but even just for its own sake. And we had people talking about the Ottoman Empire and the extent to which, or sort of raising this, a point by somebody, I think somebody tried to make recently, which was the Ottoman Empire was actually the real successor to the Roman Empire, and then, you know, discuss. And
yes,
I'm sure you've heard that being an Ottoman.
Yes, and, of course.
Where do you come down on that?
I mean, that's certainly the way in which early Ottoman leaders and intellectuals thought about it. By the time we get to the period that we're in, mm-hmm. you know, there's a very different, let's just say, you know, as the young people like to say, vibe going on in the region and among intellectuals, where, you know, whereas there was a little bit more comfort and a greater sense of gravitas with the idea of the Ottomans as an inheritor of the Roman tradition, that mm-hmm. you used the term Rumeli earlier,
right.
The term meaning the land of the Romans. I mean, it comes from right. the idea that the Ottomans were acceding not just, you know, politically, but territorially to the Roman Empire. You know, by the early 20th century, the relationship between Ottoman intellectuals and leaders, or even everyday citizens, with the Roman past is a little bit more. It's a little bit more liminal. It's a little bit less. It feels less direct. I mean, it's mm-hmm. by this time that, especially you know, within the CUP and among kind of leading intellectuals of the era, especially those who were Muslim, you know, they saw the Ottoman Empire as really a Muslim state. As a part of the, you know, a kind of representative of a Muslim world. In fact, there's right. a lot of, you know, new studies that, you know, have expanded on the idea that our concept of the Muslim world as it exists today, you know, that ranges from Mali to Bali and places in between, it actually comes out of the, you know, very it's very much indebted to Ottoman thinking during this period mm-hmm. of time. And so in this idea, you know, this sort of framework, you know, the Roman Empire, you know, is shunted to a side and, you know, in its place, you know, the Ottomans like to think, you know, Ottoman intellectuals, I should say, often see themselves in greater continuity with states that are more closely associated with Islam.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. Thanks for that. So let's pick up where we left off, which is, well, really, let's go right to 1914, summer of 1914, the Great War starts. And the CUP, the Young Turks, are now totally dominant, led by a sort of a triumvirate, led by Enver Pasha, Talat Pasha, and I forget the third one now of the triumvirate.
Jamal,
yes. And this the war breaks out. And I guess the first question is, was it, I mean, obviously, they eventually joined the Central Powers. They joined Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and Bulgaria for that matter. But was it always a for sure thing? Do you think that they were, the Ottomans would join, or that, let's say in particular, the Young Turks would join up with Germany?
No.
Because of grievance? Okay, so yeah.
No, not at all. Okay. I mean, yeah. In fact, I mean, this has again been the subject of recent work that has really changed a lot of thinking on this subject. You know, at the moment in which Archduke Ferdinand is assassinated in June of 1914, the Ottomans are not a part of the European system of alliances. It's frozen outside of it. So, As the July, you know, crisis unfolds and we begin to see inklings of mobilization and war, you know, beginning to manifest themselves in Europe, CUP leaders are really quite caught unawares and are apprehensive about, you know, what they're supposed to do. Now, going into the summer of July 1914, you know, the Ottoman Empire had actually established a working relationship with the United Kingdom in an effort to reform the Navy and expand the Navy. It had purchased rights to a battleship that was being constructed in the UK. Germany, was entrusted, a deal was signed to help reform the Ottoman land forces in the aftermath of the Balkan Wars. And there is an effort through the summer after the assassination of Ferdinand to try to feel out other powers in terms of how they thought about the Ottoman Empire. Would they be willing to sign some sort of pact or, you know, give some sort of security guarantees to Istanbul in the event of conflict? And essentially, the Ottoman Empire, and this sounds perhaps a little bit facetious or crude, but they sort of go door to door, you know, and saying, well, you know, what can you give us? You know, what do you expect? And the short of the matter is the British and the French the Russians are rather lukewarm towards the Ottomans. And it's only the Germans who seize upon this moment. And there's a bigger backstory here that the Germans had long cultivated a closer relationship with Istanbul as a way of undermining the British and the French and the Russians from the 1880s forward. And so the Germans, you know, are not only willing to give the, you know, CUP government security guarantees, but they're willing to give money, and they're willing to give, to donate ships to the Ottoman Navy. And so this, you know, becomes, you know, for the CUP leaders, a real victory, right? I mean, in June, they were isolated outside of this, system of alliances. By August, they're a part of it, and they are allied with the state that ostensibly has the strongest army in Europe. And so this is seen as a real coup. And I mean, more importantly, you know, there is a real sense of war enthusiasm among, you know, the most senior leaders of the CUP that amid this crisis, the Ottoman Empire could perhaps make some sort of potential gain and reverse some of the at least some of the heartache that had come about as a result of the Balkan Wars. And so with those sorts of kind of details in mind and with those sorts of interests in mind, the Ottoman Empire not only joined Germany and the Central Powers in August, but they also enter into the fighting by November of 1914.
Right. So how much did debt have to do with the perennial debts? We talked about this in the previous episode, how, you know, the Ottoman Empire was put under also, what was this, Ottoman Public Debt Administration, where foreigners were, at least for some period of time, helping to kind of, basically overseeing, because they were the creditors, overseeing some of the finances of the government. Like, how much did that play a role in these negotiations and in siding with Germany?
They don't play much of a role within the negotiations. It is a manifestation of this war optimism that because all the major European powers are fighting one another, Istanbul feels that it has sort of leverage and latitude to abrogate this administration, the Ottoman Public Debt Administration, which it does in the summer of 1914. And in fact, this, you know, the Germans are not, you know, particular fans of this move. They're, you know, especially obviously the British and the French and the Russians, who have a stake in, you know, the Ottoman Public Debt Administration. But this is emblematic of, you know, the old expression that, you know, you can't let a good crisis go to waste. And the Ottoman government sees this as a moment in which, you know, if it was going to, shake off these shackles, this was the time to do it.
Mm-hmm. So who exactly makes that decision to bring them into the Great Wards? It's done. They make that decision really in sort of late or sometime in October. Well, I guess they sign an agreement with Germany in August, but it's kind of secret, right? And then
Right. They do sign and they do begin to mobilize in August.
Okay.
But what remains sort of a point of contention is whether, you know, the Ottomans should actually join the fighting or remain neutral. And here, I mean, there's a great deal of apprehension. You have to consider that, you know, by October, you know, German forces are bogged down, you know, along the Marne.
Right.
You know, fighting has broken out in Eastern Europe. You know, the fate of Germany at this point is, the German success is not 100% guaranteed, far from it. But so there is some degree of apprehension within, you know, among senior leaders. But the force that prevails here is, on the one hand, is Berlin essentially coercing the Ottoman government to join the fighting through, essentially kind of withholding any, you know, transfer of money, specifically gold, to the Ottoman government. And that was among the essentially the signing bonus that comes with this secret agreement.
Right.
And the other is the enthusiasm of Enver Pasha and others, you know, who are among the main kind of wielders of power during this period of time. And it should be said, you know, that the nature of the government here is somewhat, let's just say, kind of semi-chaotic. There is, you know, historically the senior bureaucrat was, you know, which was a figure known as a Grand Vizier or a Sadrazam, which was how it was referred to in Ottoman Turkish. You know, the Grand Vizier was sort of the one who oversees the workings of government, you know, in managing it in the name of the Sultan. But after 1914, the Grand Vizier is somewhat of a secondary character in that, you know, as we understand it, you know, the Minister of War, Enver Pasha, the Minister of Interior, Talat, kind of have this bipartite, you know, system of running the state, you know, one operating, you know, kind of the foreign affairs war side of things, the other one operating the domestic side of things, you know, but, you know, how decisions are made and sort of who's a sort of, you know, if there's a sort of central, you know, not just decider, but doer, is sort of, it's really, frankly, somewhat hard to say. And it does evolve during this period of time. But, you know, be that as it may, you know, it's clear that there is a consensus by the fall that, you know, not only, you know, is this alliance a good thing, but joining the actual fighting was a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about Hans Lukas Kieser's book, Talat Pasha, in which he argues really intensely that it was Talat. It was Talat all the way. Enver is a figurehead. How do you feel about that?
I guess, I think, you know, the object of this book is to provide a kind of definitive case for, you know, not only how the Armenian genocide play out, but Talat's role as the architect of that genocide. I'm somewhat agnostic as, you know, in kind of confirming, you know, the leadership upon, you know, one figure or another, especially for the fact that for a very long period of time, you know, the received wisdom, it was Enver that was the one who was in charge. I mean, that was, you know, for a very long time, that's how, you know, this, you know, the nature of the Ottoman state at the very end was construed. I would say that, you know, if you look at issues beyond just sort of domestic politics, if we look at the conduct of the war, if we look at, you know, the even kind of the management of day-to-day affairs in the capital and the provinces, it's a far more complicated story than just, you know, this guy's in charge or that guy's in charge. You know, even though this is a one-party state with a relatively defined leadership cohort, it's clear there are individuals within the Ottoman state who have kind of fiefdoms that operate somewhat independent of the empire, at least sort of with some degree of latitude independent of the state. This is why, you know, Jemal Pasha, who is the governor, military governor of Syria, is often sort of thought of as a part of a triumvirate, is that he wields a great deal of influence kind of within the apparatus of the state. And there are others, too, that are somewhat more obscure, especially for the wider audience.
Yeah, I was reading that the governor of, or the Pasha of Izmir, in contrast to the Syrian official, did his best, at least in the early part of the war, just to stay out of it and keep
right.
Izmir out of it.
Yeah, Evrenos Bey is, you know, is his name. And, you know, he is, again, one of the more obscure characters in the story, but he's emblematic, I think, of the extent to which there are, you know, even though you have a highly dictatorial state that has developed and one that's centered around a political party, there is a somewhat dispersed sense of authority, and that there is a kind of semi-chaotic internal dynamic that governs the ways in which the state, is operated or governed.
Right. So I was going to say that I guess, so it wasn't foreordained that they would join the war at all. I mean, a lot of countries stayed out for quite a long time. But when you look at it, I mean, who were the Ottomans' sort of most immediate, as they perceived it, enemies? Russia, definitely. I mean, Russia is constantly encroaching. They'd constantly fought wars with Russia over the previous century and a half, and mostly ending in humiliation for the Ottomans. So Russia, that's Russia. The Brits have been threatening them. I guess they have a complicated relationship, let's say, with the Brits. I mean, the Brits are sort of creditor imperialism problem, but, and also they were sort of encroaching on the Arabic lands that were in the Ottoman Empire, the French also. I mean, it seems that it wasn't foreordained that they would actively join with the Germans, and maybe that's your point. But it's hard to imagine what the Entente powers would have really offered them, because in your book, you said, you know, you point out, I mean, when the Ottomans first start negotiating with the Germans, the first thing they want is to regain some of the conquered Caucasus lands, like Ajdabiya, that region, I guess, in Georgia and so on.
Yes.
Does that sound right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, it's, you know, trying to be somewhat careful not to centralize it too
right.
much. But I think that certainly the British and the French and the Russians had demonstrated not simply a willingness, but a had acted upon their urges or their tendency to partition the Ottoman lands, right? That there were very kind of clear geostrategic interests, you know, based on kind of the Ottoman map, you know, the kind of the nature of the, you know, the kind of the shape and nature of the Ottoman state that drove British and French and Russian foreign policy. And so, you know, there was definitely no romance, you know, that bound, you know, Istanbul to any of these countries,
right.
You know, having, you know, whereas conversely, the Germans never made territorial demands upon
right.
The Ottoman Empire. But there, you know, there was some degree of apprehension within, you know, within the senior ranks of the Ottoman government around sort of joining the Germans, and, you know, some degree also of, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call it hope, but a kind of a, you know, some willingness to believe that the British or the Russians, while not necessarily, you know, having a real affection towards the Ottoman Empire in and of itself, and still maintaining some degree of, you know, kind of territorial interest in the Ottoman Empire, could be, you know, convinced to maintain Ottoman sovereignty mm-hmm. or preserve the Ottoman state in order to prevent some kind of tension within the Entente Alliance, or just sort of more broadly speaking, within Europe. And this is what Istanbul had banked on for a very long period of time.
It actually worked to a degree, right?
You don't want to sort of have a war of all against all against the Ottoman Empire, because that would lead to a war of all against all between all of the major European powers. And, you know, the senior CUP leaders arrive at in terms of a decision in the fall of 1919 is, look, you know, that era is over. You know, it seems relatively clear that a great divide has now come and manifests itself within Europe, in which the British and the French are at war with Germany. Seemed unlikely that the future of the Ottoman Empire would somehow lead to the breakup of that alliance. In fact, it probably could serve as a basis to divide the empire between the Entente themselves, in the same way the Balkan, you know, states formed an alliance based on a kind of loose agreement to partition the Ottoman Balkans. So, you know, this helped push or convince pro-German or kind of those who saw, you know, the war, a war on the side of the Central Powers as a potentially beneficial thing, you know, in the long run.
It's kind of a digression, forgive me, but I've been wondering about this since the last episode. I mean, one thing we find in this show is that so-called liberation always results in deep ambivalence, if not worse. What was the Ottoman reaction to the Crimean War and the entry of Britain and France to, quote, save Ottoman territory from Russian expansion?
What was the reaction in terms of, you know, kind of the leadership or the, you know, kind
the
of
leadership, the, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, well, first of all, this is a very different time which, you know, contextually, you know, we're talking about a Europe that had grown rather fearful of continued Russian influence within the core of Europe. I mean, you have to imagine just a couple of years before the Crimean War, you know, the Russians intervene in putting down revolts throughout Eastern Europe during the revolutions of 1848. In which the Russians are expanding into the Caucasus, flexing their muscle in Iran. You know, that there are, you know, Russia is a state that is, you know, threatening to tip the balance of power. And, you know, from the perspective of the Ottomans, you know, Russophobia, because it seems almost cultural in nature, but can suffice to say this kind of apprehension towards Russia very clearly is to the Ottoman Empire's advantage. And, you know, we have to imagine too, I mean, the Crimean War comes about because of the reemergence of France as a power. And so the war, you know, breaks out because the Ottoman Empire decides to back growing French influence in the Levant at the expense of the Russians. And so there's not necessarily, you know, a kind of emotive tilt within, you know, Istanbul that's driving affairs. It's not like, you know, Ottoman officials are, you know, sitting around drinking their tea saying, oh, you know, the French are, you know, they're good guys now. This is more of an opportunity to, you know, to try to offset the influence of an encroaching power by placating another European power.
That makes a lot of sense. And actually, that kind of segues to something I wanted to talk about a little too, which is the role of people from the Russian Caucasus, as the Russians, as the Russian Empire started conquering in the 19th century, in particular, you know, the Caucasus, and particularly the Muslim peoples in the Caucasus, and the Ottoman Empire wound up. So not only had they taken in a lot of Crimean Tatars, but also all the people from that region who were expelled. I mean, a lot of the Russian campaigns to conquer those regions involved mass expulsions of peoples Chechen. I mean, we've talked about this in other Radio Warner episodes, but, you know, Chechens, Dagestanis, Abkhazians.
Circassians.
And I wanted to ask you about Circassians. Yeah, I get confused. Are Circassians a separate identity, or are they considered a general identity for... Because there are a lot of peoples in that region.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it is a confusing idea. I mean, the term in itself is kind of I would say both the Russian and in the Ottoman context is a general term used as reference to a variety of people from the Northwest Caucasus, mm-hmm. Who were broken up into smaller groups. You know, call them tribes, maybe call it something else, but, you know, for the lack of a better term, tribes. You know, whether they're Karbadians or
Balkarians.
Ubuh. Shapsukh, there, you know, there's a sort of a collection of these different groups who come, and they're actually the largest that come and settle in the Ottoman lands, and they're found everywhere now throughout, virtually everywhere throughout the Middle East. Mm-hmm. But the term Circassian, you know, is used both in reference to these very specific groups from the Northwest Caucasus, but it's also used as a general term for North Caucasian immigrants.
Right.
So they could be Karachai, they could be Ingushi, or they could be Dastani, or they could be, you know, even Chechen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, mostly we're talking about peoples from the Northwest Caucasus.
Right. Yeah, because I noticed you also seem to kind of use them sort of how they use it in a sense, both specifically and a kind of general sense, or when you quote people. So the first major, campaign, correct me if I'm wrong, that the Ottomans decide to embark on is against Russia in the Caucasus, using a lot of their Circassian, North Caucasus, emigre fighters who they rate as very good, tough fighters. We've talked on the show a lot about the legendary Chechen, fighting. It's a campaign that that the Germans, who are assigned to work with the Ottomans, are pretty uneasy about. This wasn't, if I'm not mistaken here, like Lyman von Sanders, they seem to be pretty nervous about this specific. They didn't think that the Ottomans were ready for something big. But, you know, at that time, as we've talked again a lot in the show, at that time in the Ottoman Empire and elsewhere, the thinking was always, if you will it, dude, it is no dream. I mean, if you want, you have to do something big. And if you have the willpower and the desire to do something big, then it will happen. If you don't have the will.
That was a pan-European idea.
Yes, not just Ottoman. And this seems to be their version.
The war fever was insane in almost every country.
I think it's the nature of the early fighting, you know, and I think you could sort of talk broadly, you know, between 1914 and 1915, there is an aspiration within the senior leaders that the war will be short, and that to achieve Ottoman objectives, you need to go on the offensive. And, you know, this is a time, you know, too, of, you know, in which military thinking, by and large, was dominated by offensive thinking, offensive strategy. The first to mobilize, the first to go on the offensive, would be the party most likely to win. And so the early campaigns of the Ottoman military, which you could, you know, roughly divide to both, you know, kind of regular as well as clandestine endeavors, are all offensive in nature. The Ottoman Empire invades the South Caucasus, Russian territory, as well as Iranian territory, in the winter of 1914. The Ottoman army invades Egypt also at this period of time. There is also a clandestine effort, you know, to try to raise rebellion throughout the kind of the Muslim territories of the French and the British and the Russians. And yes, I mean, the Germans, you know, who come on as advisors, both of the general staff, but also, you know, kind of leading significant portions of the Ottoman military. There is apprehension about this because, you know, there is among the Germans a broader sense of fear that an Ottoman defeat would drain German resources and attention and empower the Entente, which turned out to be true. Mm-hmm. You know, and obviously, you know, hindsight's 20/20. So it most certainly seems prescient. But at any rate, I mean, there's clearly an ideological component of this as well. And here, I mean, there's a bit of debate among historians today. You know, how much was military thinking driving these campaigns? How much of this was kind of the product of a romantic set of impulses within senior leaders, that the Ottomans would come in as liberators, the Ottomans would, you know, establish, you know, independent Muslim states in the South Caucasus, free of both the Russian and the British, and therefore dependent upon the Ottomans, and that this could somehow be a bridge to Central Asia, in which the Ottomans could, in fact, you know, extend their influence among the Turkic peoples of Central Asia. There's some evidence to suggest that, you know, ideology and military, what appeared to be the military necessity, went hand in hand.
Oh, absolutely. And there's an early 20th century feel to this, too, because it reminds me of what, improbable as it may sound, of what Pancho Villa supposedly said to his troops at the Battle of Celaya in 1915, paying no attention to the Great War at all, when they said, "We're out of ammunition," and he said, "Courage will be our ammunition," which did not work out very well. And this kind of thinking is very powerful in the early 20th century. I think it carries over to Imperial Japan.
You can see it specifically during this period of time with the Germans and the ways in which the Germans thought about Eastern Europe. You know, we think about kind of the German tendency towards building some sort of Lebensraum in the East, you know, not simply during, you know, the Second World War, and it's not simply the result of Nazism. It's a product of long-term German nationalist, you know, imagination, you know, going back to the 19th century. And there was a very similar, you know, kind of mixture of military necessity and ideology or romanticism that fed, you know, German involvement on the Eastern Front during the First World War. So it's not that far-fetched that, you know, there was a kind of, you know, kind of dual nature. There was a kind of dual nature to Ottoman strategic thinking at this period of time.
The other thing I wanted to mention in this context is that weirdo Gökalp, or however you pronounce his name, right?
No, you got it.
Okay. I mean, he was arguing at the same time for what something that's still very powerful, the Turanian idea, the Turkish greater Turkey, but in this case, much greater, like back to Mongolia almost. And in that way, he was arguing disengage from these Arabs. These Arabs have nothing to do with us, and move northeast, and this would be part of that.
No, I mean, I think here I'm a little bit more skeptical. I mean, I think, you know, Ziya Gökalp and his writing most certainly was a subject of interest among senior CUP leaders, and there's part of a kind of, let's say, mood music in 1914, 1915, at least in some quarters of the CUP, but, you know, his romantic affection with the Turkic world, you know, with Central Asia, isn't necessarily a kind of the bedrock, you know, forms the bedrock of some sort of plan, you know, or kind of a strategic outlook for the future. It's, you know, and this is where, I mean, again, we'd be a little bit more sort of skeptical, you know, because I don't necessarily think that, you know, he's the singular and most important person to plant this seed. It's, like I said, it's more of a part of a broader, you know, kind of political or ideological climate of the time, of which, you know, there's other sort of forces at play too. You mentioned, for example, kind of the relationship between you know, the government and the Arab provinces. There is no indication in 1914, 1915 that, you know, anybody in Istanbul is looking to give up the Arab lands. Actually, far from it. You know, it's actually exactly the opposite. I mean, that having said that, you know, there is a sense of cultural apprehension towards Arabs, although it's something that doesn't necessarily, is not necessarily spoken aloud. And it's hard to discern how prevalent it is, to what extent it informs policy, because a lot of the writings that we have about this period of time are written after the First World War, in which there's a lot of bitterness, in which there's a kind of really quite pronounced stab in the back mythology within, you know, kind of late Ottoman, early Turkish leaders about Arabs. But suffice to say, you know, as the First World War begins, no one in Istanbul is looking to abandon the Arab lands. More importantly, there is this belief that the war could actually help solidify Ottoman rule within places like today, like, you know, that are today Syria and Iraq and, you know, the you know, Saudi, you know, Western Saudi Arabia. These are all places that, you know, were very much in Ottoman hands, and they hope to remain in Ottoman hands. And that, you know, the you know, the kind of the short-term goals of these offensives were about promoting Ottoman sovereignty and security, but there was this kind of glaze of ideological or romantic, you know, you could say Turkish, but also Islamist, pan-Islamist, you know, ideology that comes, you know, with it too.
Yeah, that was one thing. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the sense I got from your book was that there wasn't a sort of great yearning or sort of Arab nationalism. There were sort of pockets of it, like in Damascus among Syrian intellectuals, maybe to some degree in Baghdad. There was, of course, the House of Saud fighting, Saudis, whatever, you know, fighting for, I guess, independence. But it wasn't a big widespread movement the way it was, let's say, in the Balkans. Is that right?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the critical difference is that there is not a mass mobilization within the wider Arabic-speaking Ottoman world around the idea of not just Arab nationalism, but Arab independence. Right. In intellectual circles, especially in Beirut and in Damascus, the Arab identity had become an important component and an important idiom, or sort of, you know, influences the kind of the idiom of politics during this period of time. People talked about, you know, when they talked about problems or their aspirations, they talked about Arab problems, Arab aspirations. Okay. Now, this is where it gets, again, somewhat complicated and convoluted. The CUP were of two minds about this. They weren't, on the one hand, enthralled with the idea of intellectuals trying to substantiate their grievances around Arab identity politics. That, again, that is sort of the gateway drug, if you will, to independence and separatism and so forth. Mm-hmm. That left a lot of people rather uncomfortable. On the other hand, there was a degree to which there was some, you know, willingness to accept this sort of development within, you know, specifically in quarters like Damascus and Beirut, in that these expressions of Arab identity were also often paired with the idea that Arabs were Ottomans, and that Arabs, you know, were predominantly Muslims and therefore shared in a kind of an important cultural and political stake in the Ottoman Empire. Okay. And this was especially the sentiment of the likes of Jamal Pasha, who's, again, this very important person within the CUP, you know, something of a leading figure within the party, but most importantly is the military governor of the Levant during the First World War. I mean, that he was willing to sort of abide by the idea of, you know, kind of Arab identity so long as it doesn't kind of bleed into a movement for independence and separatism. Now, you know, there is, you know, however, you know, other sources of discontent that kind of help break, you know, the bonds between the government and the vast majority of, you know, of Arabic speaking citizens during this period of time, you know, in and beyond just issues of national identity. I mean, number one, you know, mobilization for the First World War is a disaster, right? I mean, in some ways it's somewhat reminiscent of what you see today in Russia, is that you're taking large numbers of people out of the workplace, away from their fields, and the economy therefore suffers as a result. It, you know, in many places, it's actually quite extreme. You know, we see sort of famine-like conditions beginning to sort of manifest themselves as early as the spring of 1915. I mean, this is the sort of the effect that mobilization has. The other part of this, too, is that, you know, the military leaders who come to, you know, govern portions of the Arab lands do a really terrible job, you know, actually in the day-to-day affairs of government. They are abusive towards local citizens sometimes. Mm-hmm. They are, they extort local citizens. They, especially, you know, Christians and Jews in various parts of the Arab lands. We see this in Baghdad, for example. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, kind of last, you know, but not least, you know, this is a time in which, you know, the you know, people are dying at the front, and in which the Ottoman Empire by the spring of 1915 is very much losing. Right, I mean, they've already suffered a really significant setback in the east at the Battle of Sarakamish. They've already been the invasion of Egypt is defeated very early on, and then, perhaps most importantly, Entente troops had landed on the beaches of Gallipoli, you know, just, you know, within striking distance of Istanbul. So things look really bad early on. And this feeds discontent, you know, all of these factors feed discontent. And it's for these reasons that you begin to see expressions of not just, you know, kind of opposition to the government, but even sort of expressions for liberation for the from Ottoman rule.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So going back real quickly to this initial invasion, this is in December. The Enver Pasha decides to lead this invasion of the Russian controlled Caucasus. He leaves with three corps of Ottoman troops. The Russian lines of defense are 50 kilometers to the east of Erzurum. Erzurum, okay. This is an Armenian predominantly region too, right?
Yes and no. I mean, there are lots of Armenians there. There are lots okay. of different types of people there. But yes, you're not wrong.
Right. And at first things go well. Then, but as they get to where the Russian reinforcements are, the resistance gets much stronger, and then climate hits. And I just wanted to read a little bit of it. I mean, this turns into just a massive disaster that leads to other horrible things. But read a little bit from your book here. With snowfalls over a meter high in some areas and with temperatures dropping to negative 40 degrees Celsius, Russian troops regained the initiative in the first week of January. Mm-hmm. In time, they executed their own envelopment of the extreme Ottoman left, because Enver Pasha's idea was to do this. I mean, it all looked great on paper, the whole envelopment thing. By January 7th, the Third Army, the Ottoman Third Army, had withdrawn and ceded most of their gains. As units drew back toward Erzurum, a significant portion of the 10th and 9th Corps, already decimated by frostbite and exposure, surrendered to the Russians. Enver Pasha, rather than witness the lasting consequences of this reversal, returned to Istanbul, leaving what was left of his shattered army to contemplate an undoubted counterattack. But then they were decimated by typhus, dysentery, spotted fever, and Erzurum's basic medical facilities were so overwhelmed that patients who had died of disease were ultimately piled up in tents, quote, like heaps of wood, unquote. So of the 120,000 men who started the campaign in late December 1914 to invade Russia, it's estimated between 50 and 90% of the Third Army's forces were either killed, wounded, captured, or died of disease and cold. I mean, that's just incredible, you know, of a disaster. They went into it thinking, well, we saw what the Germans did in Tannenberg to the Russians, and we've got, you know, Elan, and then they left. And this, how does this sort of play into the Armenian genocide, this disaster?
Well, I mean, it's a part of it. And as I sort of referenced before, you know, we should understand the Armenian genocide in part as a result of contingency planning and also perhaps because of kind of a longer term, mm-hmm. You know, enterprise that was beginning to take shape before the war. So, you know, the Ottomans lose this important battle at Sarakamish in the winter. And, you know, through the early months of 1915, they're ceding ground. And, you know, this sort of sets off, you know, major alarm bells in Istanbul. As, you know, both, you know, the Ottoman army has been decimated, but the proposition of a Russian occupation begins to loom on the horizon. And it's clear that the Ottoman government going into the war expected acts of Armenian and Kurdish collaboration. Okay, in fact, they expected it to such a degree that even before the fighting began, Armenians who were mobilized to fight in the First World War were disarmed. Okay, and this was sort of the level
distrust,
yes, and paranoia, yes, within senior leaders, and so the real sort of bellwether moment in the eyes of the CUP is the fall of Van. Van is this town, with say southeastern Turkey, and amid the Russian capture of this town, the Armenian population actually rises up and welcomes the Russian occupation. And so this is sort of taken as this bellwether sign that Armenians as a whole throughout, not just the East, but perhaps throughout the empire, are, can no longer be trusted as citizens. And so we see, at this period of time, also kind of a cross current of different discussions independent of what's going on the Eastern Front. We see, the question of whether or not Armenians away from the Western Front are, resisting mobilization, or the fact that that Kurds, in different portions of the East were all in, as well as outside of, the front lines, were supporting either the Russians or resisting mobilization. We have this ongoing this refugee crisis, which you sort of alluded to earlier regarding the Balkan Wars, which remained very much unsettled at this period of time, in which large numbers of Balkan refugees remained homeless, different portions of the country. So all these sorts of tensions come together, and it's clear that by March, a decision is made, and it's being made amid also the strike against Gallipoli by the Allies. So, in March, we see the first efforts towards deporting Armenians away from their homes to the northern Syrian deserts, and more specifically, the appropriation of their property and the settlement of their lands with Balkan refugees. And so this happens before, you know, we kind of get to this crucial moment in April when a general order for the deportation of Armenians is issued for not just Eastern Anatolia, but eventually to other portions of the empire as well. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's an important, so this campaign or these losing campaigns early on in the conflict are important catalysts, but there's, you know, in some ways it's a, you know, it's a culmination of all these different short-term issues and all these sorts of longer-term problems that kind of feed into the decision-making around the Armenian genocide, which really begins to sort of build and gain momentum, you know, starting in April 1915.
Mm-hmm. And how is the, I mean, at this time still, there was a large Greek ethnic Greek Orthodox population on the coast, on the western coast, and in other parts of Anatolia. How were they treated, and how were they seen? Were they seen in a different light than Armenians, for example, among Christians?
I mean, the short answer to your question is poorly.
Yeah.
You know, that before the war, the Ottoman government actually entered into negotiations with the Greeks with Athens on a population exchange.
Right.
You know, that, you know, within Greek territory, especially, Greek territory conquered during the Balkan Wars, there were large numbers of Muslims. Within the Ottoman Empire, there were large numbers of Orthodox Christians. And so there's this attempt, as kind of late 1913, going into 1914, to exchange populations between the two countries, thinking that, like, look, you don't want your Muslims, we don't really want our Orthodox Christians, let's, you know, solve our problems respectively. But they don't actually reach a deal. But regardless, the Ottoman government begins to initiate a population exchange, you know, by engaging in a kind of sub rosa campaign to expel Orthodox Christians from the western parts of Anatolia. And so before the war, I mean, there's already kind of warlike conditions in the West, as, you know, tens of thousands, you know, somewhere in the ballpark of 100, 200,000 Orthodox Christians are forced from their homes in places like, you know, sort of the outskirts of Izmir, portions of areas outside of Istanbul. Now, during the war, the dynamics changed to some degree. You know, Greece remains neutral at the start of the First World War. They join later,
right?
But they remain neutral. And so the Ottoman government is somewhat out of a quandary, because there's still this looming suspicion towards Orthodox Christians. They don't really want them. But if they were to engage in measures akin to, say, what they undertake with respect to Armenians, they could potentially bring the Greeks into the war, and they don't want that.
Right.
So they settle on a policy beginning in 1915 and kind of endures to the very end of the war of internally displacing Greeks from the coastline to areas within the immediate interior. And, you know, it's somewhat of a haphazard process.
Right.
It's very much looks like the Armenian genocide, except the fact that there are no massacres. Okay.
Right.
And that
it's important to emphasize here that it wasn't just deportations, it was massacres
kind of campaigns of mass rape.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the Armenian genocide is more than just about killing. It's about the purposeful, really, elimination of Armenians as a people, as a culture throughout much of the Ottoman lands, in lots of different ways. And many of those measures are not applied to Greeks. Now, it doesn't mean that Greeks are not, you know, do not suffer, you know, some terrible injustices during this period of time. And there is, and it does, again, there's some of these measures do bear resemblance to the Armenian genocide, but it's clear the Ottoman government thought about Greeks in a somewhat different way, mostly based on the fact that the contingencies of the war demanded that they not go quite as far as Armenians. You know, bear in mind, there is no independent Armenian state.
Right.
Right? Mm. The Russians are as apprehensive about the Armenians as the Ottomans are, in fact. And so there's not necessarily the sense that, you know, there could be an exchange of populations, because there's no place to actually send Armenians in the same way you can send Greeks abroad. Mm-hmm. Or some, Bulgarian Orthodox Christians apart.
One thing we've found on the show is that it's unfortunate to be a dominated ethnic group without access to a coastline. That's very dangerous because things can be done to you very quietly. And especially with Russia, the only other power that they could have been in contact with, not really caring very much for the Armenians.
Well, it's actually not a quiet affair. I mean, people, I mean, the international news reporting on, you know, what's happening in the Ottoman Empire is actually quite consistent through the war. And it's a big part of the ways in which the international media comes to understand the Ottoman Empire through the First World War as a result of these massacres. Because it's not, I mean, they're happening in places that are today very remote.
Right.
That's true. But on the other hand, these are places in which there are really large numbers of missionaries, in which you had also large numbers of people who were fleeing the Ottoman Empire successfully. So people knew what was going on. They also understood the scale of it in real time. And as I think I mentioned perhaps before, I know you alluded to it, Mark, the phrase crime against humanity is coined during the First World War due to as a result of the condemnation of, you know, what becomes the Allied powers at the very end of the war. So they sort of, there's a prince-like name change, you know, between from Entente to Allies. And the Allies do condemn the Ottoman Empire for what they call crimes against humanity in terms of the treatment of Armenians.
Right. I mean, I think the whole concept of also is genocide, and genocide is a crime, pretty much dates to this as well, to what happened to Armenians.
Well, it is coined, you know, really after the Second World War.
Yes.
But it's an important benchmark historical movement for the early sort of thinkers and campaigners around recognition of the Holocaust, right?
Right.
That it wasn't totally unprecedented. You know, that the Armenian genocide is an important kind of event as a precedent. Mm-hmm. You know, that leads to the Holocaust.
Right. Yeah. So we'll want to get to the war for independence, but before we do that, why don't we just take a quick break, listen to some music from our man Brendan Andrig, and then we'll come right back and get to the end of this. Okay, we're back, and we want to get to the Greek-Turkish War, the War for Independence, as it's called in Turkey. as soon as we can. And the founding figure, of course, of the Republic of Turkey, Mustafa Kemal, who made his name in the battle for Gallipoli, but that's for a different episode. I think if we just were to wrap it up real quickly, I mean, obviously the war was going badly, except for the Battle of Gallipoli, which was the one sort of bright spot heroic moment for the empire. By 1918, it was, everything is falling apart. And the war is going terribly on every front. And it ends with basically a peace treaty, and the leaders of the CUP, of the Young Turks, fleeing the country in, what is it, the end of October of 1918? Is that right, Ryan?
Early November.
Yeah. Early November. Okay. So shortly before the armistice as we know it, they already threw in the towel. Is that right?
Yeah. So an armistice is signed at the very end of October,
right,
in 1918. There's no peace treaty. The peace treaty is, the peace treaty remains to be worked out. And that's, you know, kind of what they planned to have happen by through 1919.
Right. So, the Young Turk leaders leave, and what happens, I mean, we want to get to what happens in 1919 through 1922. But essentially the armistice involves the Entente powers, France, Britain, and Greece, occupying Istanbul, the seat of government, and parts of Turkey. And Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, and the Ottoman Empire itself falling apart very rapidly. And so it sort of starts to transform, power within it starts to sort of transform pretty quickly. I mean, can you sort of describe what happens leading up to the Greek invasion?
Right. I mean, this is sort of, you know, I get kind of greater detail on this in my new book. And I mean, the irony is that we think of, you know, the end of 1918 as the moment in which the empire is falling apart, the Ottoman Empire is falling apart. And it seems appropriate since, you know, this is at this very time, the Habsburg Empire dissolves itself, that the state of Germany is in the midst of revolution that would lead to the overthrow of the Kaiser. And naturally, you know, we're now talking about the early stages of Soviet Russia taking shape. So, you know, there seems like a kind of a natural inclination to think about this as a moment in which the Ottoman Empire is coming apart. And it should also be said, too, that, you know, when the war ends, you know, the battle lines within the Ottoman Empire have, you know, more or less come to rest along what is today the border between Turkey and Iraq and, you know, Turkey and Syria, more or less, you know.
Right. That's important.
So this, you know, so you could be forgiven to say that the Ottoman Empire is coming apart. You know, the reality is, though, the Ottoman Empire is still very much exists, right? And unlike, say, you know, what we see in the Habsburg lands or in Germany, there's no revolutionary moment that is beginning to take shape. In fact, just the opposite. There is a real expectation that the Ottoman Empire is going to survive, right? Or at least there is a desire among a really significant portion of the Ottoman elite, of what remains of it, to preserve the Ottoman state. Now, why that is, I think, is because of a couple of different reasons. You know, number one is, you know, a topic that we kind of referenced in the last episode, which is Ottoman patriotism, Ottoman nationalism, that there is still this real, quite vivid sense of belonging centered on devotion to the Ottoman state, devotion to the Ottoman monarchy. The other is, you know, the basis by which, you know, people expect a peace treaty to be worked out, right? And that is Woodrow Wilson's 14 points. And among the 14 points is a stipulation that the Turkish, you know, as it's phrased within, you know, by Wilson himself, you know, the Turkish, predominantly Turkish portions of the Ottoman Empire would be preserved, while those with large minorities would be allowed, you know, the opportunity for autonomous development. Okay, so Ottoman leaders looked at this and said, look, it's going to be okay. Okay, the empire is going to survive. But this doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, that the political scene is at all tranquil. It's actually, you know, quite tumultuous in terms of there being a real sense of reckoning with the behavior of the Young Turk government, its policies during the First World War, and even before it. And, you know, by the latter stages of the First World War, the empire is, you know, really has suffered terribly, not just because of the war itself, not simply because of the fighting, but because of famine, because of the deportations, which will now, by the end of the war, it's not just Armenians we're talking about. We're talking about a host of different groups who are targeted for deportations by, you know, the Ottoman government. And by what is seen as a rampant degree of corruption and self-dealing and profiteering by the Ottoman, by the Young Turk government itself, you know, through the course of the war. So when the war ends and the CUP abandons power, its leaders go into exile, there is a groundswell of popular rage. And this rage is very much manifested in the press that is anti-CUP. And that is, you know, very much determined to try to rewind the clock to a time before, you know, the CUP comes to power. And what this impulse does is really give credence and legitimacy to people who had historically been at the margins of politics through the course of the CUP's reign. And among these groups are not just political opponents of the CUP who kind of came from lots of different political, you know, sort of parts of the Ottoman spectrum, of the political spectrum, but also more specifically the royal family. Okay. And so the royal family, with the Sultan at his head, the Sultan Mehmed VI, begin to plot a kind of reestablishment of a kind of royalist regime within Istanbul that would purge the both state and society of the CUP. And it's in this context, interestingly enough, that we see the prosecution of individuals who are held responsible for acts of murder, atrocity, profiteering vis-a-vis Armenians. Okay, I mean, we have these, you know, rather expansive war crimes tribunals in Istanbul, other portions of the country as well, too, targeting CUP officials. Now, you know, so when we get to the spring of 1919, you know, some, you know, 4 to 6 months after the war is over, the Ottoman Empire is very much alive, but it is, you know, now beset by this, let's just say, kind of partisan divide, okay, over the question of political leadership, in which you have this, let's just say, kind of royalist regime that is beginning to stamp out the CUP as a force within, you know, state and society. And those who are, you know, kind of what, you know, who constitute what remains of the CUP old order, the wartime order. Now, thankfully for them, the Allies, to some extent, throw them a lifeline by, you know, prosecuting a rather expansive degree of occupation throughout the Ottoman lands. And most notably, it's in the spring of 1919 that the Allies allow the state of Greece to send troops to the western coast of Anatolia and the environs of what is today the city of Izmir. Now, this was, you know, a territory that had not been conquered during the war, that had been long the object of Greek irredentism. And so this move, you know, this act by the Allies is read with real horror throughout what remains of the Ottoman Empire. And there's a real sense of betrayal to what people thought were the going to be the terms of the of this peace treaty to come. Now, where the rubber hits the road is that the imperial government doesn't do anything to stop the occupation. Okay, so even though representatives of the Ottoman government go to Paris. They present their case to stand prepared to present their case to the, you know, the Allies at Versailles, the Allies go through with this, you know, this occupation regardless. And, you know, the Istanbul government does nothing to stop them. The only party that is vocal enough and stand prepared to do anything to cast the Allies out are officers and individuals who were previously aligned with the CUP. Mm-hmm. And it's so this sort of sets the stage for, you know, the resumption of fighting between Ottoman forces and the Allies, but it sets the stage for the ascendancy of, you know, of this new political force that is, you know, kind of directly linked to the CUP, becomes almost entirely associated with Mustafa Kemal or, you know, or Ataturk.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, and when the Greeks first invade, I mean, it's surprising to me that the Greeks could even do this. It was fairly poor, I would have thought, and a much smaller country than the Ottoman Empire. But the Ottoman Empire is just, I mean, it is fully defeated. It is suffering from the effects of 4 years of war, famine, shortages. And so what was kind of surprising reading your account is that the Greek army really cut through the Ottoman forces in Izmir and beyond, you know, like the proverbial knife through butter, as they make their way towards Ankara, I guess, to try to bring the last sort of rebellious part to heel. But that winds up being a very fatal mistake. Can you describe a little bit of what happens?
Yeah, Greece, I think, frankly, you know, this image of Greece as being a poor, you know, poor former fragment of the Ottoman Empire is, I think, you know, comes with the benefit of hindsight rather than sort of a reflection of how people at the time thought of Greece and specifically how Greek leaders thought of Greece. You have to consider that, you know, Greece expanded at the expense of the Ottoman Empire more than once through the 19th century into the early 20th century, obviously kind of the principal, you know, kind of moment of triumph coming in the Balkan Wars, where, you know, the much of what is, say, northern Greece becomes, you know, is incorporated into Greek control, but also the islands, most of the major islands. Rhodes comes later. You know, I'm talking about Lesbos. I'm thinking of only the Turkish names right now. But, you know, the major islands of the Aegean, of the northern Aegean, fall to Greek control, you know, as a result of the Balkan Wars. And, you know, Greece, you know, kind of enters the First World War, much like the Ottoman Empire, and it sees, that Greek leaders see an opportunity to capitalize upon this crisis for their benefit. Although there is a great deal of internal dissension around the Greek entrance into the war. In fact, a very brief civil war breaks out in which a pro-war party emerges around the prime minister of by the name of Eleftherios Venizelos. Mm-hmm. And Venizelos, you know, is a really quite provocative character, you know, at the end of the war, not just in terms of regional politics, but also in terms of international politics. You know, he attends the peace negotiations at Versailles. He speaks English fluently, quite artfully. He has quite fascinating background. He was originally born in Crete at a time in which Crete was a part of the Ottoman Empire. Mm-hmm. Was the descendant of, you know, what he kind of heralds as longstanding Greek freedom fighters on the island of Greece, supposedly learned English by reading the London Times while, you know, fleeing from Ottoman troops. You know, he's this rather dashing figure. And he quite, you know, handily convinces the Allies that it was in their interest for Greece to occupy portions of the Ottoman Empire, despite the fact that Greece enters the war very late. And despite the fact that there is some degree of uncertainty over, you know, kind of the future of Ottoman sovereignty, you know, where the borders should be drawn and so on. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this comes with the enthusiastic support of the British government. Now, and this was very much a support that was seen as mutual beneficials for both London and Athens. You know, Athens got the support of a major European power, the principal victor of the First World War, who would, you know, kind of enable and validate continued Greek expansion at the expense of the Ottoman Empire, making Greece ostensibly the major power of the Eastern Mediterranean. And what Britain would ostensibly get in return would be a state that would be something of a client state that would straddle, you know, this important piece of territory, you know, in the world that, you know, rested near the Suez Canal, buttress, you know, the Turkish Straits. So there was a lot of, you know, kind of mutual expectation that an expanded Greece would be to the benefit of the Allies in general, benefit obviously to Athens and to Britain in particular. Now, one thing that I detail in my new book is that, you know, kind of within the bowels of the British imperial government, there was a great deal of apprehension about this, actually, in 1918, precisely because, you know, Greece would be going into a territory separated by a body of water, in which there would be large numbers of Muslims, in which there was going to be a fair amount of resistance, in which Greece, you know, did not necessarily have the capacity to maintain an expanded footprint there, and that was likely going to lead to a great deal of conflict and instability. And, you know, these were sort of these sorts of expressions of dissent within the British government, you know, did percolate upwards, but ultimately David Lloyd George, who was prime minister at the time, overrules them. And, you know, as well as the sort of backings of other members of his cabinet. And Greece is given this, you know, kind of the, not quite carte blanche, but given this opportunity to establish a toehold in Western Anatolia with the understanding that eventually it would most likely be annexed by Athens.
Was there any thought about annexing some sort of tenable coastal area and not trying to march for Ankara?
Well, the Greek offensive that culminates with, you know, kind of the attack on Ankara in 1921, that kind of comes about as a kind of contingency that emerges in the summer of 1920. I mean, so perhaps let's sort of back up here and give you a brief timeline, right? So May 1919, Greece is allowed to send troops to Western Anatolia. And this is touches off fighting between ostensibly remnants of the Ottoman army and Greek forces. And there is a massive mobilization effort that is organized principally in the end by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, you know, who emerges as the leader of a movement that calls itself rather blandly, but, you know, becomes a rather, you know, definitive moniker. You know, the head of the national movement, commander of the national forces, aimed at enforcing a more equitable peace between, you know, the Ottoman Empire and the Allies, but in particular defeating the Allied occupation of Ottoman territory occupied after the armistice. Okay, the armistice of October 1918. So, you know, the fighting continues from the spring of 1919 through 1920. And, you know, these national forces under Mustafa Kemal actually gain a great deal of headway. They manage to force the French out of significant portions of what is today southern Turkey. They lay plans to assert greater control over eastern Anatolia, which had been or was, you know, potentially promised to an independent Armenian state. So, you know, militarily, you know, things are very much going against the favor of the Allies. Nevertheless, the Allies press forward with the crafting of a peace treaty, which it presents to the government in Istanbul, saying, look, we've come up with a peace treaty. This is what the map is going to look like. It's in your interest to sign it. Okay. And the Sultan, Mehmed VI, decides to endorse this treaty. And this the treaty that is signed is ultimately known as the Treaty of Sèvres. The Treaty of Sèvres is signed in September of 1920. Now, and from the outset, it's more or less a stillborn treaty. It's dead on arrival because according to Ottoman law, the national parliament has to endorse it as well. But the parliament not only rejects the treaty, the parliament is actually forcibly closed down by the Allies in the spring of 1920. Now, this parliament is reformed in Ankara, which is the base camp for the national forces under Mustafa Kemal. And it then comes to call itself not the Ottoman parliament, but the Grand National Assembly of Turkey. Okay, so this is actually the first time the country of the Ottoman Empire formally refers to itself as Turkey. Okay, so right. If I'm losing you, this is the basis of the story.
It's important because there's an ambivalent at first relationship between the nationalists and the nationalist parliament and the Sultan. I guess at best you could say ambivalent, which is to say that the nationalists were not yet openly, but neither side was openly hostile to the other. But it was clear that they were not going to...
I think the finer point is that they were hostile with one another, but there was no clear movement to establish a new country called Turkey, let's just say, or to dissolve the Ottoman Empire. Okay? And in fact, that ambivalence more or less endures until the very end of the fighting in 1922. But the critical part of the Treaty of Sèvres is that it more or less confirms the idea that the royal family and those who support this royalist government in Istanbul were willing to compromise on issues of Ottoman sovereignty for the sake of defeating what it saw as a greater threat, which was the remnants of the Committee of Union and Progress. Now, you know, Mustafa Kemal was a member of the Committee of Union and Progress. He was somebody who had actually, you know, very much indebted to the Committee of Union and Progress in terms of his, you know, his upward sort of ascendancy within the Ottoman army and so on. But he was very much a personal antagonist possessed a great deal of personal antagonism with senior CUP leaders, most notably Enver Pasha. So, you know, there is a kind of deeper backstory of how, you know, his status within the CUP as somebody who had been a part of it from the beginning, but somebody who was not a friend of the senior leaders of the party, helped kind of provide a basis for his, you know, kind of consolidation over this national movement, over the national forces. And he uses this fact as a wedge to not only kind of bolster the legitimacy of what he feels is the national forces, but bolster his own rise as kind of this new political force in the country. Right.
Yeah, after you've made the Sultan's party, I mean, or after they've made themselves into something like collaborationists, you can easily position yourself as the defender of the nation.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, but, you know, what's quite fascinating is that there is a degree of ambivalence, one could even say confusion, throughout this period of time over what to call the country. what do you call its citizenry? You know, what is happening with the state and the nation overall? And, you know, you see some kind of interesting expressions of ambiguity, you know, going up until 1920-21 over what is this place, you know, that is, you know, kind of fixed on the map that had been called the Ottoman Empire. Is it Turkey? Is it still the Ottoman Empire? By calling it Turkey, do you mean something totally different? And where you get a real definitive turn is with the defeat of the Greeks. Now, you know, to sort of go back to what you referenced before, John, about the attack on Ankara, the Allies understand that the peace treaty is more or less dead letter when it's signed, and that the only way that it's actually going to be enforced and actually going to be take any kind of material shape is with the defeat of the national forces. Now, the British were not willing, nor were they necessarily able to accomplish that themselves. After all, if you consider the time, they were fighting rebels in Ireland. India is in upheaval during this period of time. Rebellion breaks out in Iraq in 1920. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and as well as there's sort of discontent in Palestine, I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, fires that are alight throughout the British Empire. So the British weren't going to do it. The French were actually really quite ready to make a side deal with, you know, Mustafa Kemal and with, you know, with the national forces. The only one who were really willing to do anything in the name of this treaty, the Treaty of Sèvres, was Greece. And so, you know, the Greek government more or less volunteers to pursue the destruction of the national forces, and they nearly accomplish it, nearly take Ankara in the summer of 1921, but fall just short. And when, you know, Mustafa Kemal emerges from this battle outside of Ankara, which is known as the Battle of Sakarya, it's very clear that Mustafa Kemal now commands the future of what is the Ottoman, what remains of the Ottoman Empire. And so from this point forward, the Ottoman moniker begins to die away. People don't call the Ottoman Empire the Ottoman Empire anymore. People now almost exclusively refer to it as Turkey, since it's what the name, it is the name that is given to the state by the national forces. And this is, you know, why this is somewhat of a reflection of, you know, the language that's used in the Treaty of Versailles and the Wilson's 14 points, but also I think the kind of final ascendancy of the likes of those like Ziya Gökalp and other Turkish nationalists who were influential during the First World War, but really, you know, kind of come into full control of the ideological content of this movement and of kind of the political consensus that is taking shape within Ankara.
Well, it's also a big sort of, you know, thing at the time as well. The new nationalisms and new nationalist states, you know, in the sort of post-Wilsonian world where it, I mean, as you said, like all of a sudden the Ottoman Empire seemed like an anachronism. It started to see, and whereas a nation with a national people and language was suddenly the thing, at least throughout Europe.
Newness was fetishized in a big way during this period of time. Youngness more than youth. Right. Youngness, like having young-like qualities,
right.
As well as, you know, kind of the newness. I mean, it's during this time that the phrase New Italy enters into parlance. Eventually, we'll talk about a new Germany under National Socialism. And during this period of time, you know, a phrase that becomes, you know, basically universal post-1921 is New Turkey, right? That New Turkey was in a phrase that was in contrast to the Ottoman Empire, which you have to consider, 1922, the Ottoman dynasty had ruled for six centuries. It is the oldest dynasty, ruling dynasty of Europe. And that fact was very much out of step with what was happening in the world at large. And Ataturk in particular at this period of time represented a kind of youth that was not only kind of lionized within Europe, but he himself seemed to embody a new kind of spirit in the country. And he very astutely placated those impressions. He played to them very willfully in a number of different ways. And so, you know, by the time we get to the very end of our story here, sort of 1922, you know, he and his forces emerge, you know, kind of victorious at the expense of the Allies, leading to yet a new sort of round of peace negotiations, this time in Lausanne, that culminate in 1923. There's no question that, you know, he is the singular force that is defining the future of the country, whereas the dynasty seemed very much of like a relic of the past.
Right. Mm. So real briefly, when the Mustafa Kemal Ataturk's forces, the nationalist forces, fight, sort of repel the Greek forces from Ankara and then all the way back to Izmir, basically, what was the scale of human destruction, civilian destruction? I mean, I know that from the Greeks there was as well on non-Greeks, but when the Turks retook these areas, what was the scale of sort of expulsions and suffering?
Oh, it was you know, really quite traumatic. And it's, you know, we're now kind of living the centennial of this, you know, of this event, and much of people's attentions, and for good reason, much of popular attention focuses on Smyrna or Izmir and the burning of the town in the latter stages of the war in September 1922. And it was very much a, you know, an act of destruction, a deliberate act of destruction, so it seems, targeting the town's Orthodox Christian and Armenian populations. But in preceding this, you know, when the Greeks retreat through Western Anatolia, they set fire to towns and villages all along the way. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the true death toll of the Greek retreat has never really been calculated. Although, you know, when peace negotiations are convened in Lausanne, you know, the representatives from Ankara more or less, you know, provide, you know, rather detailed descriptions of the scale of the of physical destruction, you know, destruction of villages and towns, which are, were quite expensive. You know, it's anecdotally, you know, one thing that we can say for sure is that, you know, Turkey in the 1920s is a place very much emptied of people. And this is a, you know, they've been emptied of people for a lot of different reasons, either due to the fighting going back to the Balkan Wars, to the First World War, and then again, you know, as a result of the fighting between, you know, the national forces in Greece, the national forces in the French. Most of the towns in the south and the west portions of Turkey were afflicted by the this, you know, by the fighting during the War of Independence. And so the scale of destruction is really quite dramatic. And it's, you know, goes in and beyond this, the destruction of Izmir or Smyrna.
Okay. I think at this point we can wrap up an amazing discussion with Ryan Gingeris on the end of the Ottoman Empire. In fact, I want to remind again, and we'll put this in links, that his newest book deals specifically with this period. It's The Last Days of the Empire. That's his newest one through Penguin Press in London. And we're going to give links to other books and articles in this. But I want to let you go. You've spent a lot of time with us, and we really appreciate it.
Well, I've really enjoyed it. It was, you know, it was a lot of fun. And thank you so much, you know, for your questions and, you know, and for your interest. I'm quite flattered that it resonated with you guys.
Definitely. We're going to want to get you back on the show if you'll still spend more time with us, but we'll definitely, there's a lot to talk about. So
not at all. Anytime. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay. That's the end of part two of our interviews with Ryan Gingeris on our series on the fall and demise of the Ottoman Empire, the rise of Turkey. And again, we'll post all the links to his books. And it's amazing history, very bloody, very merciless, and incredibly relevant and fascinating as well. But one thing I just wanted to say, John, I don't know what you think about this. Like, I mean, I'd like to bring on Ryan another time because I've heard him. He'll also talk about Erdogan and sort of placing him into context of all the stuff we talk about as well.
Yeah.
I mean, he's written a lot on Erdogan policy. In fact, he had an article, I don't know, sometime in the last year about how he thinks that there's a real chance, not an insignificant, not a joke, but a real chance that Erdogan may launch some kind of short victorious war, as they say, against Greece, basically in the run-up for his campaign for president next year.
Well, he will at least restart the war in Syria.
Yeah,
Been
we see it
announcing that for a long time. But and there's no penalty for that because Syria is not NATO.
Right.
Starting a war against another
seems crazy. NATO, I know.
Nation. Well, who knows? At least
I know
they won't be able to say no. Turkey is our NATO ally anymore.
And that's where I wanted to bring up, I mean, history. You know, there is any time you read about, in at least the Angloid press or the Angloid punditry, about Erdogan is this authoritarian baddie. Mm-hmm. And they're very kind of, you know, the people who tend to take that position are the people not on his payroll, which is not a lot of DC and London, but there's some of it. They get a little nervous about it because Turkey is a NATO ally. It's the second largest military in NATO and a very deep key ally of the U.S. But it is a complicated relationship. There's no doubt it is a complicated relationship. Yeah. And the way they seem to sort of talk around this is to pathologize Erdogan? Like, why does he have a good relationship with, or what seems to be, I wouldn't call it a good relationship, I'd call it a very practical relationship with Putin. Practical in the sense of not being ideologically hyper anti-Putin, let's say, but more sort of trying to straddle the line.
Sure, I mean, this has been going on for a long time. I mean, what's wrong with America? Trump. Okay, like it was all fine before he came along.
Right.
Erdogan is a symptom of a long contagion that was never really cured.
Right.
And was always going to bubble up sooner or later. Trump, in the same way, is a symptom of an oligarchy on its last legs. And this way of just identifying a single person as the source of the whole infection is ridiculous.
Well, yeah, and the idea is he has the illiberal authoritarian virus, and sort of like in Marvel in comic books, bad guys create bad guy lairs. So the Penguin and the Riddler and stuff will be together, and good guys will be in the League of Justice. You know, that's why Erdogan has what appears to be, it's not right to say friendly relations with Putin. It's right to say not sufficiently hostile, not at all, but it's complicated, I would say. But when you look at the history, I mean, Mustafa Kemal is, as the founder of modern Turkey and that whole period, it's a lot more present than in a lot of other countries' founding history, I think, in Turkey. And look, they were founded on humiliation at the hands of the West. You know, they were founded on humiliation, hands of Britain and France. And also when Kemal came to power, what they sort of realized, like the big innovation over the Young Turks was, hey, let's stay out of wars. Let's not take sides in these things. What did he say? It was something like peace abroad, peace at home. And even though they joined NATO, and that's again for another story, and I've heard Ryan talk about it, a lot of that had to do with the fear of communism rather than wanting to get involved in a war, a domestic fear of communism.
But that suited NATO just fine.
Exactly.
In the post-1945 era.
That was
exactly the kind of proof of virtue they wanted.
Yes.
Yeah, and in fact, Kemal's Turkey got the coastal province of Hatay from Syria without having to fire a shot. So it was a much better policy.
Right. And I think that when you get into Turkey's history, late Ottoman Turkey history, Erdogan's role as sort of not wanting to get overly excited for the Ukraine war, but sort of playing both sides. I mean, I guess that's a decent way to call it, but sort of not taking one side and running with it all the way that the US and London want you to. You have to take one side or the other. I mean, it makes sense in their history. They had a very awful experience in the founding of Turkey, that whole period, by taking a side. And
were other things that were imposed, not so much by foreigners, but by the Kemalist regime itself, above all the secularism, because but Kemal Atatürk, as he later became known, didn't impose that, didn't change Turkish from being written in an Arabic alphabet to a Latin alphabet, because he was a defender of whatever you want to call democracy, but because he thought those things were slowing Turkey down, making it inefficient. There's a lot of loathing for Turkey's, I mean, if you want to say so, he himself was very much an Orientalist, and he had a deep loathing for a lot of what had been Ottoman culture. Mm-hmm. And that was imposed on the entire population of Turkey, along with the removal of the veil. And you really can't do that and expect it to last. It may last in some of the cities. It's not going to last in the countryside as long. And when the pressure's off, or when some party like the AKP realizes that they can make political capital out of this, it's going to be revived much like Nixon revived the Southern strategy and completely overturned the political landscape of the U.S. very quickly, very easily.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, the point here, we're not, obviously, this show has been very critical of Erdogan throughout the now going on 8 years. But you also need to understand where it's coming from. And this has been a great discussion with Ryan Gingeris to help us sort of get a deeper understanding of what's going on there. So I think here we can wrap it up. Thanks again to everybody. Thank you to Ryan Gingeris for spending time with us. And talk to you next month. Bye, John. Bye, everyone.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Bye.